This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America is on the verge of creating a new interstate highway system. It's not about roads, and it's not about cars. It's a computerized, cable-connected information highway that will carry video images, sound, and data. It has the potential to change entertainment, shopping, education, research, and long-distance communication. There are lots of important questions to be answered about who will own it and who will make the rules, who will have access. My guest, Mitch Kapor, is one of the people working to ensure that the information highway will be as widely accessible as possible with few limitations on content. Kapor co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, dedicated to realizing the democratic potential of new computer and communications media. He also founded the software company Lotus Development Corporation and designed its most popular program, Lotus 123. I asked him to explain the information highway.
The cable and telephone companies are in the process of rewiring their networks to be able to deliver not only existing voice and one-way television, but interactive voice, data, and video. As much of it as you want, hundreds or thousands of channels. And that whole system is a kind of an information highway system. And there will be major arteries that run across the country that could be thought of as the superhighways. And then there will be a series of on-ramps and off-ramps and driveways, and that will be the pieces of the network that will actually run into the homes.
Give us like the rosy scenario version of what the information highway could do for us and what we could do with it.
Well, if you want to look to the upside, these networks are likely to become the major conduits for not only entertainment, but also commerce and education, and will provide a plethora of new services, and will actually form a new communications medium that will be very open, will support a diversity of points of view and many different voices and shades of opinion. It will be used to stimulate a new kind of political discourse. It will bring people who are socially isolated together into virtual communities. Oh, and by the way, you'll be able to get every single Arnold Schwarzenegger movie ever made at any time of day or night.
Oh, because you don't have to go to the store to rent a movie and they only have 4 copies.
By punching some particular buttons on your remote control, you'll be able to select the particular movie out of thousands of movies whenever you want it.
Okay, so in the best-case scenario, we can select whatever movies we want. We could shop through this. We could probably vote through it. We could talk to each other. What about the pessimist scenario about what happens if it's not done right?
Well, the pessimistic scenario is really that the uses will be very narrow and limited to something like the delivery of entertainment and maybe interactive shopping. Pessimistically, it will be some small group of very large corporations which will determine the content and the uses and not the users. It will be closed rather than open. It will be limited to a very narrowly defined set of purposes that will serve commercial interests, and it will really fail to serve larger social interests. And oh, by the way, it will create a further gap between the information haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, I guess in the pessimist scenario, you get the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie anytime you want it, and you can't get much else.
That's right. Well,
you can't get the independent filmmaker.
Right. You'll be able to get the Hair Club for Men network also.
Right. Now, the models that we have for thinking about interconnection in America are the public utilities, the phone company, cable TV. How might the information highway compare to those models?
Well, the big question, there are a couple of big questions about the nature of the network. One of the key issues is whether the network is going to be divided up into channels the way cable television is, or whether it's going to be more like the existing phone network in which anybody can talk to anybody else. Hence, the total number of simultaneous programs or conversations is extraordinarily large. In a channelized system, even one of 500 channels, there's going to be a real limitation on who can say what, and that is not going to promote diversity. So the existing telephone network of the models that you cited is a pretty good one, because it does support point-to-point communication. Anybody can say anything. And it also operates under what's called a common carrier regime, which basically means that the network owner and operator doesn't have the ability to control the content or discriminate. If you want to get on the network, you can get on. If you want a phone, you can get a phone, and you can say what you want to say. And so that type of architecture and that type of policy seems to make the most sense.
So you want the most open system possible in terms of the two-way communication possibilities.
That's right.
Of the information highway. Now, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a system that uses computers and cable TV so that we can watch, we can speak, we can type? What's all the hardware that would be connected through this information highway?
Well, right now, people are frantically trying to sort this out. There will be a much smarter version of the cable converter box that sits on top of the TV. That will be one of the principal ways that this network will enter the home. It will really be a very powerful computer, hopefully one with a nice, simple user interface that you can control with your remote control. And that is how you will do your information surfing and select your video programming and do your interactive shopping. I also think that there will be another feed will come off that wire and will go into either a personal computer or a descendant of today's personal computers. That will be a much smaller unit with a screen. It will probably have either some sort of a keyboard or a mouse or something like that. And you will do your informational types of activities, your messaging, and maybe even your video conferencing that way.
Who is fighting behind the scenes now to see who will control the information highway?
Well, there's been an extraordinary upsurge in business activity in the cable industry and, to a lesser extent, among the local telephone companies to form alliances, to build experimental networks of the future, to get involved in agreements with computer companies. The private sector really has the bit in its teeth at this point, because it's become an article of faith that movies on demand and interactive shopping are going to make them a lot of money. So there's just been an enormous momentum in that arena. You know, we haven't said anything about another very important area of development, which is that there is something called the Internet, which is, it's seemingly a wholly separate development. And the Internet is a network of computer networks that grew up out of the research community and served sort of universities, which has now expanded very dramatically to begin to serve businesses and the general public. And there are some millions of people connected to each other through the Internet, not only in the U.S. but around the world, who use it every day as a medium for communication with electronic mail and transferring files of information back and forth, and even beginning to do some multimedia. In fact, there are more people on the Internet, which is this very highly decentralized, very open system, than any other information infrastructure. And the Internet, in a lot of ways, exemplifies the kind of values of openness that we are talking about. And one thing that nobody has really asked, and it's certainly not understood, is what is the future of that Internet? Is it going to remain its own thing? Is it going to be taken over by cable? Is it going to merge into it? It's not clear.
What do you think we should learn from the success of Internet and try to apply to the information highway?
Well, I think there are a number of very important lessons. Some people call the Internet the world's largest functioning anarchy. It is a case in point that you do not need to have a very tightly and centrally controlled authority running a large network, that we know enough in the digital era about how to do things in a way that does not enforce that type of rigidity. And when you do have that type of open system, you get a lot of innovation. You get people trying out all sorts of new services and new ideas. It's a very fertile ground for innovation. And therefore, you can get very rapid development of user populations, and you get all sorts of interesting new phenomena emerging. When the internet first started, the whole idea was to let the computer scientists at MIT, when they came in the morning, get access to computers on the West Coast that were underutilized because it was 6 in the morning. Instead, it turned out that what people did was electronic mail. They wanted to exchange messages. They wanted to communicate with each other. More recently, we've seen the emergence of what some people are calling virtual communities or wide area communities. These are groups of people that are held together not by their geographic proximity, but because they hold some interest in common. But they really function like a real community with insides and outsides and norms and values and strong feelings and shared experiences. And I think the internet teaches us that networks can be a way that people can get closer to one another. And so it's a very serendipitous and positive example of uses of technology.
Who runs the internet? Is there anybody who owns it or runs it or creates the rules on it?
Well, it is a collection of distinct networks, each of which is administered by somebody. It may be a university. It may be a private entity that sells connections to businesses that wish to be on it. And all of these intermediate networks are interconnected with one another, really not through any formal authority, but because all of those parties have agreed to do that through a series of arrangements. So it's a collective organism. It's not a single entity.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Mitch Kapor, a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he was also the founder of Lotus Software Company, and he designed their most popular program, Lotus 1-2-3, a spreadsheet program. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mitch Kapor. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He also founded Lotus Software Company, and he designed their most popular software, Lotus 1-2-3. And we're talking about the information highway. There's so many issues involved with how the information highway could be created, and yet so many Americans aren't even computer literate at all, let alone able to comprehend all the issues involved with this, which I think mitigates against this being a very, very democratic system. In other words, in terms of input, in terms of everyone in America contributing some kind of input to the design of the system.
Well, I agree with you that there is a big understanding gap, and that this all seems very abstract to most people, and perhaps more than a bit frightening. And sometimes people who are involved in this as a business like to keep it that way because it makes it their little secret. I mean, I really think now is the time to have the public discussion on all of these issues before critical decisions are made, before we wake up to the creation of another vast wasteland in one of the pessimistic scenarios. And when Newton Minow said that, I think it was, around 1960, it was already too late by at least a decade, if not more, to do anything about television. The great thing is we still have some time now because the fundamental decisions have not been made irrevocably. And therefore, those citizens who have an interest in participation, and of course, democracy is voluntary. You're not required to vote. You have the option to vote. This is a good time to get involved and to learn more about what's going on and to ask the difficult questions.
Now, you started your group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, after the FBI came looking for you, not because of something you did wrong, but because of information they wanted from you to help track down somebody else. Would you tell us the story?
Well, it's peculiar because I had not had any contact with our law enforcement agencies. At one point, somebody sent me anonymously a diskette, computer diskette, with what purported to be the source code or instructions making up part of the operating system for the Macintosh computer, the heart, soul, and brains of the Macintosh, something that Apple guards very fiercely. I looked at it, realized it wasn't mine, and contacted Apple and sent it back to them for them to do with what they want. 6 months go by, and I've put the matter out of my mind completely. I get a call. The FBI wants to come and talk to me about this because they are trying to find the people who did this. And so two agents showed up, and I wound up having a very long and painful conversation with them because it was evident that while they were set with this task of tracking this down, they had not a clue about computers or source code or operating systems, and they didn't know, you know, a computer chip from a cow chip. Not their fault. They weren't trained for it, but they were being asked to do this. And it was a very disturbing experience because I could see that no good was likely to come out of it. I filed that experience away in my mind. But a couple of months later, a friend and colleague of mine whom I had met online in a computer conferencing system called The Well had a similar experience. They came and talked to him. This is a guy named John Perry Barlow, former cattle rancher, lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and all-around troublemaker. And he was moved to write something about the bizarreness of his experience of talking to the FBI. It struck a bell with me. I mean, it really resonated. And we got to talking about this, and we realized that there was this terrible disconnection between the sort of avant-garde of technology users who were online, using bulletin boards, communicating, logging on to computers through the internet, and the rest of the world, including the law enforcement agencies, and that there were conflicts and that there were misapprehensions and mistakes. And in particular, we saw that there was a whole class of innocent people that were in the process of getting chewed up by the law enforcement system. The Secret Service was after hackers. There are a lot of kids running around, breaking into computers, stealing computer cycles, making free telephone calls, and doing things that they shouldn't be doing. But in the process of going after them, they were being demonized. They were being made into the new red menace. And not only that, other people, completely innocent parties, people who were operating computer bulletin boards, businesses just to talk to their customers, were getting their computer equipment seized. So we felt we had to do something. And that's the genesis of the EFF. Now, our conception of what had to be done has grown a great deal. At first, we thought what we needed to do was to ensure that the civil liberties of computer and network users weren't being violated. And we thought we would need to do that in court. And in fact, we've had one court case that concluded recently in a very favorable fashion that rose out of the matters around which we were founded. But what we really discovered very quickly was that these conflicts between cops and hackers were symptomatic of a broader set of issues of society trying to adapt to and digest all of this new technology. And we said, what we think will help is if we create an organization that can try to educate people, try to broaden awareness, one that has a very strong commitment to civil liberties and the productive and beneficial uses of this technology. And that's where EFF came from.
Now, it's interesting to me that you got into this because the FBI was tracking you down for information that would lead them to computer pirates, people who had tried to disseminate the Apple computer secrets. Mm-hmm. Now, you were the founder of Lotus Software. And in fact, the program you created, Lotus 123, that has the reputation as being the most pirated software in history so far. So I imagine on some level you were probably very sympathetic to wanting to crack down on the computer pirates.
Well, my sympathies are probably as much with the users of computers as they are with the people who make the software. And clearly, people who make the software are entitled to a fair return on their efforts. And when piracy is committed on a conscious basis or on a basis where there is a profit motive, I mean, clearly that's highly illegal and ought to be. But we have problems in the society making appropriate distinctions between a kind of piracy for profit and somebody... a kid who is fooling around and makes a copy of a program and uses it, who wouldn't buy it to begin with, and is experimenting. I'm not condoning the behavior, but I am saying we need a lot more proportionality in how we think of that, and we need to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. And it seems to me that sometimes the holders of the intellectual property rights take an attitude of lock them up and throw away the key, which is overbroad and quite inappropriate. So it is not a black and white situation. The copyright owners need to be protected, but at the same time, if they go about it in a heavy-handed way, which unfortunately happens quite a lot, then the users need protection. We really have to rethink a lot of notions about property and business in the digital era, because software is just different than tangible things like lawnmowers and forks.
Why did you get out of the software business? And are you still creating programs even though you're not marketing them?
I stepped aside from Lotus in 1986 fundamentally because I don't like big companies, even ones that I started. I'm more interested in creating products than running a business, and I just found it personally burdensome. Some people enjoy the presence of command and the ability to sort of move large armies of employees and make headlines and cause things to happen, and I just found myself having more and more sleepless nights worrying about all the responsibility. So I was happy to step aside, as it was not my ambition to create and run a $250 million a year company, which is the size that it was then. I haven't been actively designing software, but I have quite a few notebooks filled with ideas, and at some point in the next few years, I'm likely to turn my hand in some fashion to making some of them into products.
Mitch Kapor, I want to thank you very much for talking about this.
You're welcome.
Mitch Kapor is the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.